content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the January 7th, 2025 online edition of the New Yorker. Open question section. Why are we tormented by the future? Caught between competing impulses, we praise living in the moment while obsessing about what's to come. By Joshua Rothman. Not long ago, my six-year-old son was in the bath, building cities out of colorful foam blocks. City blocks, he said. Get it? One metropolis on the tub's outside edge was supposed to be based in the present day. Another, closer to the wall, was a future city. A third was constructed on a purple rectangle that floated in the water. What's that one on the purple island? I asked. It's a present city, he said. It's between the future and the present. The present. Does that sound like a nice place to be? To my ears, it registers as possibly exciting, but also as frenzied and unpleasant. Yet, I often feel that I'm living in the present. On a typical afternoon, at 2 p.m., I am aware that I have a Zoom call coming up, and then an urgent email to write, and then dinner to make at home, and then the kids' bedtimes to navigate, and then a few more paragraphs to draft, and the concluding chapter of a thriller to finish reading before bed. I also know that I have a reference letter to compose over the weekend, a column to plan for next week, and a book due in a few months' time. My days are saturated with a consciousness of the future and unfold like ongoing reactions to what's to come. Technology is a culprit because it transforms the present into a waiting game. My phone says that rain will start in 15 minutes. Netflix tells me that the new Wallace and Gromit movie will soon be available. And a light on the car's dashboard warns that maintenance will be required soon. This stream of notifications leaves traces behind on my future timeline. But I suspect that I dwell in the present even when unplugged, simply by disposition. My imagination projects itself more forward than backward. There have always been thinkers who have argued that the past, present and future are basically constructs of the mind. Augustine, for example, believed they were mental categories created to help us comprehend change. In an overview of the concept of time published in this magazine, Alan Burdick writes that although we say that we experience a present, it's likely true that now arises again and again only because we say now again and again. By the same token, however, one might get in the habit of saying, and then, again and again. Apparently, I've rotated my mind like a satellite dish toward the future by default. The future, in itself, exerts an attractive force, not just the general future with its bland procession of potential events, but the futuristic future, with its alluring, fascinating, and forbidding narrative turns. AI looms, along with drones and robots, clones and climate change. If a bird flu pandemic arrives, we will need new vaccines. And if Elon Musk's Neuralink progresses further, we may someday have chips in our heads. Will all this happen in 20 years, or 10, or 2? Or are other stranger possibilities likely to intrude? The political future clearly is studded with alarming milestones. The philosophy of long-termism suggests that we should also be concerned with problems that might plague our far future descendants, from rising seas to the appearance of a global totalitarian surveillance state. The eyes of all future generations are upon you, Greta Thunberg warns. Meanwhile, our personal futures are maps with waypoints we've charted but may miss. College, marriage, work, family, retirement, and everything else we picture for ourselves. The future, in short, is overstuffed, full of elements that demand our attention, perhaps legitimately, maybe too much. In his book, Time Surfing, The Zen Approach to Keeping Time on Your Side, Paul Lumens, a Zen monk and a time management coach in Amsterdam, describes a 7-point method for resisting the time pressure created by a densely packed, onrushing future seeking to cram itself into the present. Essentially, he advocates allocating your time intuitively. Instead of living a hectic, overscheduled life, you do what strikes you as worthwhile now, dwelling with the single task or person in front of you, and trusting that what matters to you most will also matter to you organically in the passage of time. Push out from shore and surf through time using trust and intuition as your guide, Lumens writes. But this eminently valid advice, meant to apply to the personal side of life, sits uneasily alongside the equally reasonable view that we live too much in the present, ignoring the future toward which we're careening both as individuals and as a civilization. It's as though the present and the future are at war. This exact scenario is dramatized to bewildering but fascinating effect in Christopher Nolan's movie Tenet. I had to watch it a few times before I realized that I liked it, in part because of how well it evoked my own desire to resist the invasion of the future into my life. It's a paradoxical desire, of course, because the future that I might wish to evade or resist is my own. There are many aspects of life that pull us in opposing directions. We need to be pessimistic enough to prepare for bad outcomes, but optimistic enough to undertake new projects. We need to see people both as enmeshed in systems that push them around and as free agents shaping their own lives. It is vital to be skeptical and ask questions, but also to recognize the limits of what you can discover for yourself and trust in received wisdom. Similarly, it's important to think constantly about the future while finding space to live in the present. But this balancing act grows more difficult in a semi-dystopian, science fiction-tinged, media-saturated society in which the future always seems to be becoming more salient, visible, lurid, exciting, and imminent. We're used to thinking about how the weight of history shapes our culture, our politics, our psyches, but the future has weight too, perhaps these days a growing weight. It helps, I've found, to cultivate a few different visions of the future. Over the past several years, I've profiled a number of science fiction writers, among them William Gibson and Kim Stanley Robinson. There's value in seeing how they differ. Gibson, who coined the word cyberspace, envisions a future in which giant companies hold sway over a world that's increasingly fractured, confused, unequal, and ecologically damaged. He's described his novel, The Peripheral, from 2014, as taking place in a near-future version of America that's like the movie Winter's Bone, but with better cell phones. Robinson, by contrast, imagines timelines in which we extricate ourselves from these problems through arduous political, social, and economic reform. Naomi Alderman, in her guardedly optimistic climate change novel, The Future, writes, "We are always in the process of catching up to the future. Only when we get there, it's never what we imagined." This makes it more valuable to imagine the future in a searching, structured, and detailed way. How else will you discover that, as Alderman writes, sometimes, just once in a while, it's better? One of Alderman's characters suggests that imagining bad futures creates fear, and fear creates bad futures. The word futures, plural, is suggestive. It's easy for a consensus future to emerge and for our separate ruminations to center on the same scenarios. In Robinson's The Ministry for the Future, A climate policymaker explains that she and her colleagues model scenarios. We track what has happened and graph trajectories in things we can measure, and then we postulate that the things we can measure will either stay the same or grow or shrink. The inescapable fact, she admits, is that scenarios with good results are extremely rare, which means that new ways of thinking are needed so that new scenarios can be discovered. New things will have to be measured. New trajectories will have to be explored. Through this process, the future isn't so much faced as poked, prodded, played with to create more futures. At the end of each bath time, my son's city blocks fall into the water. Then they drift in a little multicolored flotilla toward the end of the tub, where the drain has created a tiny whirlpool, visible as a bubbly swirl. The blocks are all headed in the same direction, but their exact configuration is always different. They sometimes arrange themselves in surprising designs. It is easy to obsess about the future, and a little harder to stop obsessing about it. The hardest and most useful thing is really thinking about it. And now I'll read the article mentioned in the previous story from the December 26, 2016 issue of The New Yorker, The Secret Life of Time. It may seem slippery and maddeningly abstract, but it's also deeply intimate, infusing our every word and gesture, by Alan Burdick. Some nights, more than I like lately, I wake to the sound of the bedside clock. The room is dark, without detail, and it expands in such a way that it seems as if I'm outdoors, under an empty sky, or underground in a cavern. I might be falling through space. I might be dreaming. I could be dead. Only the clock moves, its tick steady, unhurried. At these moments, I have the most chilling understanding that time moves in only one direction. I'm tempted to look at the clock, but I already know that it's the same time it always is, 4 a.m. or 4:10 a.m. or once for a disconcerting stretch of days, 4:27 a.m. Even without looking, I could deduce the time from the ping of the bedroom radiator gathering steam in winter, or the infrequency of the cars passing by on the street outside. In 1917, the psychologist Edwin G. Boring and his wife, Lucy, described an experiment in which they woke people at intervals to see if they knew what time it was. The average estimate was accurate to within 50 minutes, although most everyone thought it was later than it actually was. They found that subjects were relying on internal or external signals, their degree of sleepiness or indigestion. The dark brown taste in your mouth is never bad when you have been asleep only a short time. The moonlight, bladder cues, the sounds of cars or roosters. When a man is asleep, he has in a circle round him the chain of the hours, the sequence of the years, the order of the heavenly bodies, Proust wrote. Instinctively, he consults them when he awakes and in an instant reads off his own position on the earth's surface and the time that has elapsed during his slumbers. It may also be a simple matter of induction. It was 4:27 a.m. when I last woke at whatever hour this is, so that's what time it is now. The surprise is that I can be so consistent. William James wrote, "All my life I have been struck by the accuracy with which I will wake at the same exact minute, night after night and morning after morning." Most likely, it's the work of the circadian clocks, which, embedded in the DNA of my every cell, regulate my physiology over a 24-hour period. At 4:27 a.m., I am most aware of being at the service of something. There is a machine in me, or I am a ghost in it. And once the ghost gets thinking, there is much to think about, most of all how little time I have in which to do all the things I'm thinking about and how behind I am. Until very recently, that included a book about, of all things, the biology and perception of time, which had preoccupied me since before my kids, twin boys, Leo and Joshua, now 10, were born. In its wake is everything else. The melting ice caps, the cost of orthodontics, the rise of demagoguery, the gutters I have to clean before winter, if winter really comes. The end of the year is nearly here, and still my schedule is scattered across 4 productivity apps. As worried as I am in these waking moments, I also find them oddly calming. It's as if in falling asleep, I had fallen into an egg and woken as the yolk, cushioned and aloft on an extended present. It won't last, I know. In the morning, the hours and minutes will reassert themselves, and this seemingly limitless breadth of time will seem unreal and unreachable. The dream of boundless time, dreamed from the confines of an egg carton. But that's a thought for tomorrow. For now, it's now, and the tick of the bedside clock is the muffled beat of a heart. For more than 2,000 years, the world's great minds have argued about the essence of time. Is it finite or infinite? Does it flow like a river, or is it granular, proceeding in small bits like sand trickling through an hourglass? And what is the present? Is now an indivisible instant, a line of vapor between the past and the future? Or is it an instant that can be measured? And if so, how long is it? And what lies between the instants? The instant, this strange nature, is something inserted between motion and rest. And it is in no time at all, Plato remarked in the 4th century BCE. But into it and from it, what is moved changes to being at rest, and what is at rest to being moved. For St. Augustine, writing his Confessions in the year 397, time was even simpler. It is us. Augustine was 43, beginning his tenure as an overwhelmed bishop in Hippo, a port city in North Africa, during the decline of the Roman Empire. The literature on time perception generally begins with Augustine, because he was the first to talk about time as an internal experience, to ask what time is by exploring how it feels to inhabit it. Time may seem slippery and maddeningly abstract, but it's also deeply intimate, infusing our every word and gesture. Its essence, Augustine argued, can be gleaned from a single line of speech. Deus creator omnium, God, creator of all things. Say it aloud or listen, in Latin, 8 syllables alternating short and long. Each of these latter lasts twice as long as each of the former, Augustine wrote. I have only to pronounce the line to report that this is the case. Yet, how do we manage to make this measurement? The line is composed of syllables that the mind encounters in succession, one by one. How can the listener consider 2 syllables at once to compare their durations? How can one hold the longer syllable in mind? Its duration can't be defined until it's completed, but by then both syllables are gone. Both have made their sound and flown away and passed by and exist no more, Augustine wrote, asking, so what now exists for me to measure? Here, Augustine arrived at an insight so fundamental that it's taken as a given. Time is a property of the mind. When you ask yourself whether one syllable lasts longer than another, you aren't measuring the syllables themselves, which no longer exist, but something in your memory, something fixed and permanent there. The syllables leave an impression that persists in the present. Indeed, Augustine wrote, what we call 3 tenses are really only 1, past, present, and future are all immediate in the mind. Our current memory, our current attention, our current expectations. There are three tenses or times, the present of past things, the present of present things, and the present of future things. Augustine plucked time from the realm of physics and placed it squarely in what we now call psychology. In you, my mind, I measure time, he wrote. Words, sounds, and events come and go, but their passage leaves an impression. Either time is this impression, or what I measure is not time. To consider this present is to glimpse the soul, Augustine argued. Modern science has abandoned the soul in favor of probing the framework of consciousness, a concept that is only slightly less elusive. Yet we share a rough idea of what's meant, a lasting awareness of oneself moving in a sea of selves, dependent yet alone, or a deep and common wish that I somehow belong to we, and that we belong to something even larger and less comprehensible, and the recurring thought, so easy to brush aside in the daily effort to get through our to-do lists, that our time matters precisely because it ends. So much, all that matters for Augustine, unfolds in a sentence. Recite a poem or a psalm by heart. Your mind strains to recall what you've said and reaches forward to grab what you will say next. Memory pulls against expectation. The vital energy of what I am doing is in tension between the two. Vital energy, that's the essence of Augustine, and of you, too, right now, as you absorb these words. Strive to remember and wonder what comes next. Time is nothing other than tension, Augustine wrote. And I would be very surprised if it is not tension of consciousness itself. William James often could not sleep. In 1876, recently appointed to Harvard as an assistant professor of the nascent science of psychology, he lay awake thinking about his future wife, Alice Gibbons, with whom he was deliriously in love. 7 weeks of insomnia outweigh many scruples, he told her when he finally poured forth his desire in a letter. A decade later, he fretted in the dark about his years-long, two-volume, 1,200-page book, The Principles of Psychology, which would become a classic almost as soon as it was published in 1890. Robert D. Richardson, in his biography, William James in the Maelstrom of American Modernism, notes that James' insomnia worsened when his writing was going well. In the late 1880s, he resorted to using chloroform to fall asleep. Perhaps, awake in the dark, James was annoyed by the insipid image of a procession of sheep. Or perhaps, like Augustine, he lay there absorbing the now. Where is it, this present, he wrote in Principles. It has melted in our grasp, fled ere we could touch it, gone in the instant of becoming. The array of subjects tackled in Principles included memory, attention, emotions, instinct, imagination, habit, the consciousness of self, and automaton theory, the persistent notion of which James disapproved, that within our neural machinery lies some sort of homunculus or mini-man that offers a living counterpart for every shading, however fine, of the history of its owner's mind. One of the more influential chapters is about the perception of time. It's a deft synthesis of the work of other researchers and of James' thoughts on the subject. In Europe, scientific interest was shifting from pure physiology to the neurological signaling underneath, abetted by a transition from philosophy to a more rigorous study of mind and cognition. In 1879, the first laboratory for experimental psychology opened in Leipzig, Germany, under Wilhelm Wundt, who sought to quantify sensation and inner experience. The exact description of consciousness is the sole aim of experimental psychology, Wundt wrote. James did not believe in consciousness per se, by which he meant that it should not be addressed as some sort of extramolecular mind stuff. Those who still cling to it are clinging to a mere echo, the faint rumor left behind by the disappearing soul on the air of philosophy, he wrote. Still, like Augustine, James felt that one could get a decent look at it by examining how we perceive the present. Sit quietly, he proposed. Close your eyes, turn off the world, and try to attend exclusively to the passage of time, like one who wakes, as the poet says, to hear time flowing in the middle of the night and all things moving to a day of doom. James was paraphrasing Tennyson. What do you find there? Likely very little. If you notice anything, he wrote, it's a sense of the moments blooming one after another, the pure series of durations budding, as it were, and growing beneath our indrawn gaze. In the late 19th century, before Einstein and relativity, scientists and philosophers were debating whether time was a real thing. Can we perceive a pure moment, a budding blank duration? If so, we must have some special sense for it. The Austrian experimentalist Ernst Mach even wondered if humans had distinct receptors, perhaps in the ears, that are attuned to it. This seemed unlikely to James. You cannot perceive empty time any more than you can intuit a length or a distance with nothing in it. Look up into a clear sky. How far away is 100 feet? A mile? With no landmarks for reference, you can't say. It's the same with time. If we perceive time's passage, it's because we perceive change. And for us to perceive change, the time must be somehow filled. An empty duration alone will not stimulate our awareness. So what fills it? We do. The change must be of some concrete sort, an outward or inward sensible series, or a process of attention or volition, James wrote. In stopping to consider a seemingly empty moment, we fill it with a stream of thoughts. When you close your eyes and shut out the world, you still see a film of light inside your eyelids, a curdling play of obscurest luminosity. For Augustine, the present wasn't something to observe. It is spoken and inhabited. Or perhaps it inhabits us. Time is a volume, and we are its vessel. For James, it was the other way around. Time is the container to our thoughts. The present moment is undefined without our mind to fill it. Either way, in considering the moment right here before us, we can never quite escape ourselves. We are always inwardly immersed in what Wundt has somewhere called the twilight of our general consciousness, James reflected. Our heartbeats, our breathing, the pulses of our attention, the fragments of words or sentences that pass through our imagination are what people this dim habitat. In short, empty our minds as we may, some form of changing process remains for us to feel and cannot be expelled. Even that formulation gives time too much credit. I lie awake in bed in the pre-dawn hours, watching empty time flow. We tell it off in pulses, James wrote. We say now, 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 or we count more, more, more as we feel it bud. Time seems to flow in discrete units. It seems somehow independent and self-contained. Not because we perceive units of empty time, but because each of our acts of perception, or more likely, our memories of those perceptions, is discrete. Now rises again and again, only because we say now again and again. The present moment, James contended, is a synthetic datum, not experienced as much as manufactured. The present is not something we stumble through. It is something we create for ourselves over and over, moment by moment. We begin as cells, with one kind of time inscribed in our genes. Everything beyond that is learned, and the view among developmental psychologists going back to Piaget is that humans come to know time only gradually. One basic insight emerges in the first few months of life, when we learn to distinguish now from not now. Although the seeds of this awareness probably reach us even sooner while we are still in the womb. Several researchers have demonstrated that human hearing becomes functional in the second trimester of gestation. And it's been shown that the heart rate of a fetus quickens when it hears an audio tape of its mother reading a poem, and slows when a female stranger reads the same thing. A recognition that requires a basic grasp of vocal rhythms. Not until about age 4 can children conceptually distinguish before from after. One stage in this development is the dawning awareness of self. For the first 3 or 4 years of life, many researchers think, a child does not distinguish between his own memories and ones that are recounted to him. Tell him about your trip to the Empire State Building, and he may later remember the event as if he had gone himself. Recollection is itself so new that it's as if all memories belong to him. Gradually, he recognizes his memories as his alone, and so recognizes a self that persists. I am me, made up of my memories. I was me yesterday, and my expectations, I will be me tomorrow. The self is Augustine's sentence of now, stretched to a much greater length. What is true of the poem as a whole is true equally of its individual stanzas and syllables. The same is true of the whole long performance in which this poem may be a single item. One morning at the breakfast table, when our boys were about 5, one of them described a nightmare he had just had, the first dream he seemed to recall. He was walking in a wilderness when an invisible voice asked, "Who are you?" This blew my mind. It seemed obvious to me, if not to him, that the voice was none other than his own. So here were two selves confronting each other, one self unknown to itself, at least one of which was self-aware enough to ask humankind's most existential question. But once a new self realizes its continuity, it pauses. I will always be me. Always? How long is that? A self capable of noticing that everything around it expires can't avoid concluding that it will too, somehow, sometime. And so, right around the time that Joshua and Leo turned 4, the hard questions began. What is die? Will you die? When will you die? Will I die? Are people made of meat? When I die, who will blow out my birthday candles? And who will eat my cake? Years ago, long before I had children, or was even married, a friend with children said, "The thing about having kids is that after a while you forget what it was like before you had them." The idea was shocking. Busy enough with my own life, I couldn't envision a future self whose comings and goings were circumscribed, apparently happily, by the wants and needs of people half my size. But that's what's happened. As I grew into the role of parent, I sometimes felt as if I were taking apart a ship and using the planks to build a ship for someone else. I was building a ship across time, out of my time. When the questions about death began, it was spring, slipping toward summer, and for weeks Leo was waking ever earlier. Maybe it was the light seeping into the room he shares with his brother, or the chorus of robins that erupts just before dawn. At 5:30 a.m., Joshua was fast asleep, his stuffed bunnies crushed against his face to keep out the day. But Leo, bright-eyed, would tiptoe into our room and hover by the bed.
"I want to play a game," he whispered.
He meant, "You come too." We tried technology. The boys couldn't tell time, so we bought a clock that resembles a traffic light. You set it for, say, 6:45, at which time the light changes from red to green, the signal that it's okay to get up and make a racket. But it had the opposite effect. Leo would rise early, get sent back to bed, and then lie awake staring at the red light with mounting impatience. Several times in the next hour, he would pad into our room to announce in a whisper,
"It's not green yet."
Or he'd flop around and sigh so loudly that he'd wake his brother, and soon both of them would be chattering and laughing at the mystery of the red light's intransigence. By the time 6:45 arrived and the light turned green, an event they greeted with a cheer, their official release came as a relief to everyone. At first, I let Leo go quietly downstairs by himself, and I mashed the pillow over my face and fell back asleep. But increasingly, I found myself getting out of bed and following him. In September, the boys would enter kindergarten, and their lives would begin to expand furiously outward, away from us. Although it was gradual, we sensed that we were on the brink of a transformation, and the days took on a crystalline quality, as if we had already begun to view them from memory. The boys sensed it too, if only from us. A quiet half hour alone with one boy, by his request, no less, was a gift. Leo and I sat on the wood floor, with the back door open to the sound of the robins, and played another round of bingo, or checkers, or, so help me, mousetrap, until Joshua came shuffling in, gruff and rumple-headed, like me without coffee, and issued his own directives, one sentence budding into the next. Now, now, now. Now, from the comment section of the July 13, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine, History's Lessons on Anti-Immigrant Extremism. Even Donald Trump's recent assertion that he would use executive action to abolish birthright citizenship has a historical link to the Chinese-American experience. By Michael Luo. President-elect Donald Trump has vowed to begin enacting the anti-immigrant agenda at the center of his campaign the moment he takes office. Mass deportations, a crackdown on people pouring up through Mexico and other places, as he puts it, even the elimination of birthright citizenship. The fate of high-skill immigration is one area of uncertainty. A dispute over H-1B visas consumed MAGA world over the holidays. The scale of what Trump has promised is difficult to fathom and without recent precedent. A century and a half ago, however, a movement to cast out a different group of people began to accelerate in the United States. In April 1876, a California State Senate committee held a series of hearings in Sacramento and San Francisco on the social, moral, and political effect of Chinese immigration. By some estimates, well over 100,000 Chinese were living in the state. Government officials, police officers, and civic leaders testified that they represented the dregs of their native land and were rife with a criminal element. They lived in crowded, filthy conditions, as one witness put it, more like hogs than human beings. They were vectors of disease and licentiousness. Perhaps most important, as a years-long economic depression settled over the country and San Francisco seethed with thousands of unemployed white men, the witnesses argued that Chinese workers drove down wages and took jobs away from Americans. A California pastor proclaimed that white laborers must either starve to death or they must fall to the level with the Chinese, or else they must themselves leave the country. More than 10,000 people in California and Nevada joined local camps of the Order of Caucasians an organization that aimed to protect the white man and white civilization. In July 1877, a rally in San Francisco erupted into days of rioting as mobs rampaged through the Chinese Quarter and vandalized Chinese-owned businesses, mostly laundries, across the city. Several weeks later, the state senator sent an urgent message to Congress, warning that white residents up and down the West Coast were beginning to feel a profound sense of dissatisfaction with the situation, and there would come a day when patience may cease. A treaty between the U.S. and China guaranteed the free flow of people between the two countries, making politicians in Washington reluctant to impose restrictions. But, then as now, the nation was evenly divided politically, and the western states were a strategic prize for both Republicans and Democrats. Winning them, it seemed clear, rested on resolving the Chinese question. As a result, in 1882, the U.S., for the first time in its history, closed its gates to a people because of their race, when Congress passed a bill barring Chinese laborers from entering the country. The legislation later became known as the Chinese Exclusion Act. Immigrants still found ways in, though, so Congress passed progressively more onerous laws. Restive residents of dozens of communities across the West also banded together to drive out their Chinese neighbors. Yet, the Chinese were not passive victims. In 1892, after a new law required them to obtain a certificate of residence that established their right to be in the country, leaders of the community organized a campaign of resistance. Anti-Chinese leaders, in turn, vowed mass deportations, only for the effort to founder when it became clear that the measure would be exorbitantly expensive. The Chinese community managed to persist, but it existed in a kind of permanent stress position until 1965, when President Lyndon Johnson signed into law an overhaul of the immigration system. Today, economic anxieties are again fueling overtly racist, populist appeals from politicians. A nimbus of outrage among working-class voters has propelled the MAGA movement, much like the rage that drove the anti-Chinese movement. Even Trump's recent assertion that he would use executive action to abolish birthright citizenship, scholars dispute whether this would be lawful, has a historical link to the Chinese-American experience. In 1898, 30 years after the 14th Amendment established the principle as a way of safeguarding the rights of formerly enslaved black Americans, the Supreme Court upheld it in a landmark case brought by a native-born Chinese-American, Wong Kim Ark. One of the tragedies of Chinese exclusion is that the anger toward the immigrants was likely misplaced. Chinese workers were not usually in direct competition with white workers. In an economic study published in 1963, the historian Ping Chu found that in California, the two groups were mostly stratified into different labor pools, with the Chinese concentrated in lower-wage jobs in agriculture and industries such as textile and cigar manufacturing. It was competition from more technologically advanced and efficient factories in the East, along with the broader shift to mass production, that were the biggest factors in the economic travails buffeting white workers in California. Other scholarship has similarly suggested that excluding Chinese labor failed to lift the fortunes of white workers. This past fall, a group of economists released a working paper on the impact of the Chinese Exclusion Act on Western states. They found that it took a significant toll on the economies of Arizona, California, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, and Wyoming, the states with the largest Chinese populations, until at least 1940. The economists also found no evidence that the average white worker benefited from the departure of the Chinese, and concluded that the positive effects of Chinese immigrants in the workforce, including the economies of scale achieved by their presence, outweighed any employment opportunities that emerged from their absence. The findings are hardly surprising. A recent study from the Brookings Institution asserts that a surge in immigration helps to explain the strength of the U.S. economy since 2022, benefiting employers who need workers and contributing to consumer spending. In the 19th century, the Chinese had few public defenders. John C. Weatherid, a bank executive in Tacoma, Washington, wrote in his diary on October 1, 1885, a month before the Chinese were driven out of his town, that there were, quote, a great many fools on the anti-Chinese subject, and that he felt like taking up for the underdog in the fight, end quote. He praised the Chinaman for his industry, economy, and sobriety. But Weatherid and other sympathizers mostly kept their feelings to themselves. As an emboldened Trump administration prepares for a new crackdown on immigrants, history offers lessons on the cost of silence. Next, from the January 2, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, how sheriffs might power Trump's deportation machine. To carry out the new administration's immigration agenda, the Border Czar is counting on the enthusiasm of local law enforcement, by Jessica Pishko. One of Donald Trump's main campaign promises, one that was printed on signs at the Republican National Convention and at Trump rallies across the country, was mass deportation. In November, Trump announced that Tom Homan, the architect of family separation during his first term, would be his pick to see this promise through as a border czar. Homan is enthusiastic about the task ahead of him. "They ain't seen the S word yet," he said in July. "The effort would look less like mass sweeps and more like targeted arrest," he said recently on 60 Minutes. "We'll know who we're going to arrest, where we're most likely to find them based on numerous investigative processes." Both Trump and Homan have indicated that local law enforcement would be involved in carrying out the mass deportation plan. Ryan Zinke, a Republican representative from Montana, who served as Trump's first Secretary of the Interior, declared, "The sheriffs know the bad characters. And there's an advantage to the county sheriff in particular. Nearly all of them are elected officers who are not beholden to other officials, even blue state governors, many of whom have shown a willingness to work with Trump anyway. Because immigration is in the realm of federal law, the role of local law enforcement in policing the border has historically been limited. But in 1996, President Bill Clinton signed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which expanded the criminal charges for which a person could be subject to deportation. As immigration became linked to criminal law, local law enforcement, especially county sheriffs, who enjoy relative autonomy, free from direct oversight, and have jurisdiction over much larger areas than, say, urban police departments, began to play a critical role in the deportation machine. In counties along the U.S. border, sheriffs receive funding through a FEMA grant program called Operation Stone Garden to purchase equipment such as snowmobiles and squad cars for use in conjunction with Border Patrol. Like all law enforcement officers, sheriffs have a great deal of discretion in how they conduct traffic stops and arrests, which can bring more people into jail, where some deportations begin. In county jails, most of which are run by sheriffs, arrestees submit to background checks and can be held or processed for deportation proceedings. A program called Secure Communities, started by George W. Bush and expanded by the Obama administration, identifies potentially deportable people in jails. At a national law enforcement conference in 2008, a former sheriff in North Carolina said, "If you don't have enough evidence to charge someone criminally, but you think he's illegal, we can make him disappear." In 2014, the program was modified slightly to prioritize the deportation of individuals accused of felonies, the so-called Felons Not Families guideline. The following year, The Enforcement and Removal Operations, ERO, Branch of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE or ICE, set several agency records relating to arrests and deportations. It was led, at that time, by Tom Homan. Another federal program, called 287G, grants sheriff deputies permission to act as immigration agents themselves, questioning arrestees about their nationality and transferring them to ICE's custody. During the first Trump administration, the sheriffs clamored to join 287G, and John F. Kelly, then Secretary of Homeland Security, called the program a highly successful force multiplier. Many people who were deported had been charged with misdemeanors, even something as simple as a broken taillight. The Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR or FAIR, which is part of a network of anti-immigration groups linked to the far-right figure John Tanton, recruited sheriffs to join 287G as a way to project a tough-on-crime image. Trump's new administration is poised to alter existing guidelines so that even more arrestees can enter deportation proceedings. In some states, it is possible that sheriffs will be able to arrest people for simply crossing the border. In 2023, Texas passed Senate Bill 4, which would allow local Texas law enforcement to arrest individuals suspected only of violating immigration law. It is being disputed in the courts. Similar bills passed in Iowa and Oklahoma, where they are also under court challenge, and in November, Arizonians voted to implement ballot measure 314, a comparable law. Though the newly elected sheriff of Maricopa County, Jerry Sheridan, the lieutenant to the infamous sheriff Joe Arpaio, has said that he doesn't think the law applies to his office, he has expressed a willingness to detain people in something similar to Arpaio's Tent City. Because most sheriffs are elected, governors or attorneys general have little power over them. They are excluded from the Hatch Act, which bars some government employees from engaging in political activity while on the job, and largely permitted to campaign in uniform. They can make decisions about department policy without seeking approval and with low risk of public opprobrium. They often voice political opinions. Before the presidential election, one Ohio sheriff went so far as to threaten residents who publicly supported Kamala Harris. In a 2021 fundraising letter, the Claremont Institute, a conservative think tank that the Times has called a nerve center of the American right, and a part of the advisory board for Project 2025, asserted that sheriffs have jurisdictional latitude. In the Institute's view, this places them on the front lines of the defense of civilization. For that reason, Claremont, alongside other anti-immigration groups such as FAIR, whose new law enforcement advisor is Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb, a Homan collaborator, has turned its focus to recruiting and training sheriffs to help execute its agenda. In 2021, it created an annual week-long retreat called the Sheriff's Fellowship, which received funding from Betty DeVos to study and discuss the political, philosophical, institutional, and historical arc leading from the American founding to today's militant progressivism and multiculturalism, according to a promotional brochure sent to potential applicants. At the end of October, just a few days before the 2024 election, a dozen sheriff's fellows gathered in Huntington Beach, California, to discuss pressing topics for the potential Trump administration, including the three pillars of Trumpism: the American censorship complex, how the deep state operates, and, of course, immigration and national security. They spent 5 days studying such texts as an essay by the former Hoover Institute scholar Jeremy Carl, who advocates for eliminating temporary protected status designations, challenging birthright citizenship, and allowing the military to legally fire where necessary on anyone invading U.S. territory. The fellowship culminates with the American Sheriff Award, bestowed upon a Claremont Fellow, to recognize and honor the sheriff's extraordinary sacrifice in their steadfast defense of the Constitution, its blessings of liberty, and the American way of life. This year, the winner was Sheriff Bill Wayborn of Tarrant County, Texas. He posed for pictures with a statuette of John Wayne. Wayborn has faced criticism in his community, which includes Fort Worth, because since he took office in 2017, more than 60 people have died while in the custody of the county jail. In 2020, Chastity Congius, a 21-year-old with multiple mental health disorders and an intellectual disability, gave birth alone in a cell of Wayborn's jail, and her baby died. When asked about Wayborn's record of jail fatalities, Ryan Williams, the president of Claremont, responded via email, "Public officials face difficult choices and trade-offs, especially those in law enforcement. We hope that the training they receive with Claremont, and I pray the guidance of Almighty God, will help them make these decisions in wisdom and justice." On November 5th, Wayborn won re-election. Inviting county sheriffs into the fold moves Claremont closer to the real political power. Sheriffs have great influence in rural and suburban communities, where voters are probably more likely to know their sheriff's name than that of their senators or governor. And it's clear that the incoming Trump administration sees sheriffs as crucial partners in the work ahead. On a recent trip to Arizona, with the talk show host Dr. Phil, Homan met with a group of sheriffs. There, he emphasized his eagerness to help these sheriffs make their communities safer and secure the border once again. And he intimated that the work could start before Inauguration Day. "We are not waiting," Homan said. "Game on. Today." We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.